All right. Well, first of all, to someone in back, I cannot find my papers and my water with all my notes, so I need to have another copy printed out and someone to bring that up to me, please. That would be tremendous. All right. So, hello, everyone. My name is Jim Powell. I'm the lead pastor of Richwoods Christian Church. And for the last several weeks, our church has been doing a series of messages around the series, Who is Our Neighbor? And the word there, as some of our Muslim friends may recognize, is the word neighbor. And then we've been talking about the church, Jesus, and Islam. And just talking about, very good, thank you, sir.
Anytime.
I appreciate that. And so we've been talking about just from a Christian point of view, what our responsibility is as Christians. Unfortunately, on behalf of Christians, there are a lot of Christians that really their influence, their understanding of Islam is completely shaped by what they see in the news and the media. A lot of American Christians are scared of Muslims. They don't have much understanding at all. And fortunately, I was very blessed to be able to meet Camille Mufti at a series of lectures at Bradley University a few years ago, along with Rabbi Daniel Bogart, and we began to meet and have acquaintance and to build a friendship. And actually went, he invited me to come to the mosque and do a series of lectures on Christianity on a Wednesday night, and then I actually went to observe the prayers on a couple of occasions. And then we just felt like our leadership team at Richwoods felt like it was time for our church to begin to introduce the conversation to those of us that are Christians. What does it look like to be a Christian, and what is really, do we believe that Jesus is calling us to do to reach out? Because the Bible makes it very clear that we are called as Christians to love our neighbor, and unfortunately, we don't do that very well. But I'm very proud of our church. We've done a great job in this series. It's been very enlightening. We've had a lot of really good stories from people that have really had their understanding opened and their hearts touched by what we've been going through. And so tonight is sort of the wrap-up of the series. And so what we're going to do is be taking questions and answers for the last several weeks. We've been asking, allowing our church members to submit any questions that they want. And so they've been submitting those questions, and tonight we are going to be answering those. So with that being said, would you give a warm welcome to my friend, the imam, the resident scholar from the mosque behind us, Camille Mufti. So come on. Have a seat. Well, very good. So I've been practicing. Tell me how I do. Salam alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Perfect.
All right. Very good. Working. So very good. Working on my greeting. All right. So very good. Well, we're going to jump right in. So we've had a lot of questions, and some of those we were able to send to you ahead of time, and some that have been coming in later. And so we're going to try to, what we're going to do is we're going to group these questions together based upon the ones that have been sent in over the last month. And then in the back of the room, all right, we have in the very back of the room over here, we have some 3x5 cards. If you have a question that pops into your mind, at the end, if we have time, we'll take additional questions. But what you have to do is you have to go fill out a 3x5 card, write your question down, and then we're going to take those questions at the end if we still have time. So we have a couple pages of questions that we have to go through. The first thing we're going to go through is just basic beliefs, and we're going to go through some questions about beliefs, and then we're going to talk about Jesus, practice, attitude towards other faiths, women and children, etc. Okay? So first of all, just a basic question is, do you think of and pray to God as your father?
The quick and easy answer is no, but now comes the explanation. When I've talked to my Christian friends, it seems like they have an understanding to refer to God as a father figure. And they think that when Muslims refer to God as Allah, they are referring to a foreign God who they cannot relate to with personally, a distant God. And that's not the case. The word Abba, for father, it comes in the New Testament 3 times. And there was really a Lutheran German scholar who spoke about referring to God as Abba or praying to God as the Father. And he said essentially 3 things. He lived a while back ago, and his work was translated into English by a British scholar. One, he said, is that Jesus referred to God in a childlike manner, like baby talk, referred to God as Abba. The other thing which he said is that this established a special relationship between Jesus and God, referred to as the Father in prayer. And he said that this is because of his special intimate and tender relationship, which comes from this word. The third thing which he said is that It was distinct from the practice of Judaism because even among Jews, they, in some cases, the rabbis refer to God as Abba. Muslims refer to God as Rabb, or Ar-Rabb, which is an Arabic word. This word has two primary connotations. The first of this is that he is a master who has no equal, and his blessings surround the creation with his gifts. So it can be translated as the sustainer, as the master, the cherisher, the Lord. All of these words, they are contained within the meaning of the word Ar-Rabb. The word Ar-Rabb is the most commonly used word in the Quran when referring to God. When prophets in the Quran, and you know, last week, how many of you were over here last week? Okay, most of you. So you're familiar with that many of the biblical prophets, Muslims believe in them. It's a central tenet of Muslim belief to not only accept, but to believe in those prophets, like Abraham and Moses, Isaac, Aaron, so on and so forth. So their prayers in the Quran, they always refer to God, most of the time they refer to God as Rabb, Lord, Cherisher, Sustainer, Nourisher. The second meaning of the word Rabb, and this is the most common way in which Muslims refer to God as well as Rabb, is that he is the nurturer of his creation. But at the same time, he is not their father. I just want to point one thing over here. When I talked to some of my Christian friends, some Christian scholars, they also told me that there was a discussion after the writing of this book, and this idea was then taken by Roman Catholic priests as well, in praying to God as Abba or the Father, that there was a discussion among some Christian schools of thought if it is okay to refer to God as Daddy. And what they came up with is they said it's too disrespectful and it lacks formality. So they gave up the idea and they said father is still maintains that level of respect. And then, of course, the feminist writers, they said, well, this is not acceptable at all to refer to God as a father, as in a father-like figure. But as Muslims, it's a gender-neutral word, which is Rabb, and it contains these connotations, and that's how Muslims refer to God. And the Muslim God is not a distant God. He is not a personal God in the sense that he dwells inside his creation or he lives inside his creation, but he is someone Muslims pray to continuously. And he's the one who hears their prayers. He responds to their prayers. He's compassionate towards his creation. He's merciful. He's loving. So he's not distant. He's ever ready to listen to the pleading of his created beings.
Yes. Okay. And then along those lines, so do you believe, so obviously we do practice at our church, we refer to God as our Father, as Jesus primarily prayed to God as his Father. And so that would be an area that we would differ in.
Sure.
About Muhammad being, so we've got a few questions about Muhammad. So do you believe that Muhammad is divine and do you pray to him? And then why does Muhammad occupy such a high position as opposed to other prophets?
Okay, one, I think this is a very common misunderstanding and I'm not quite sure where it comes from because I don't think a lot of Christians have the same misunderstanding with the Jewish prophet or teacher, Moses. So I'm not sure why this misunderstanding comes among a lot of Christians. It's very widespread. And that's Muslims somehow pray to Prophet Muhammad. So when the Orientalists, when they were referring to the Muslims some centuries ago, when they had colonized most of the Muslim world, they called Muslims Muhammadans. Just like the believers in Christ were called Christians, the believers in Buddha were called Buddhists, believers in court, they said Muhammad, were called Muhammadans. And Muslims never refer to themselves as Muhammadans. They always refer to themselves as Muslims as those who have submitted to God. Islam being surrender to the will of God, a loving, willing surrender to the will of God. So to Muslims, Muhammad is not a divine figure. He never claimed to be divine. In the Quran, as a matter of fact, it says, say, O Prophet, God commands Prophet, tell this to people, I am a mortal man like all of you. He never claimed divinity for himself. As a matter of fact, I do not know of a single sect, and we have quite a few sects. Over 1400 years, there have been quite a few sects.
Unlike Christians, that we're just one big happy
yeah,
family, just so you know that.
No one, not a single sect that I know of ever referred to Muhammad as being God, peace be upon him, or having divine qualities They never believed and worshipped in Prophet Muhammad as a god, ever. So I'm not quite sure what is the source of this misunderstanding. And because of this misunderstanding, I see many people, and obviously this is because of the lack of information, saying that Jesus is alive, Muhammad is dead. So it's, and I never hear them say, Jesus is alive, Moses is dead, because that would really be the comparison. Because to us, he is just a prophet like Moses and Abraham. Or saying like, you know, Jesus is alive, but Abraham is dead. Well, I think all Christians know that. And they believe that, yeah, Abraham is dead, Moses is dead, Aaron is dead, Isaiah is dead. All of those biblical prophets, they're dead. I don't think any Christian believes otherwise. So in the same way, yes, Muhammad, peace be upon him, he is also dead. He was no more than a prophet. And that has been the central belief of Muslims. As a matter of fact, this is one of the things Muslims like to emphasize. But that's not to say that Muslim God is dead. One of the most beautiful names of God is Al-Hayy in Arabic, which means the ever-living. And Al-Qayyum, which means who subsists by himself, and he maintains and sustains the rest of his creation. So he does not depend on anyone, but everything other than him depends on him. So these are two of his most beautiful names, Al-Hayy, the ever-living, and Al-Qayyum. And he is the ever-living. So in some way, Al-Awwal wal-Akhir, which is very similar to the Christian concept of the Alpha and the Omega.
Okay, very good. And so, and then I think that part of the reason, from my understanding, you can correct this if I'm wrong, is that part of the reason that Muhammad occupies a high position is because the Quran was given, you believe the Quran was given to him, and then he had that... shared those revelations with someone who dictated that. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, okay, when we say high position, right? Muslims believe in all prophets, without exception. One of the most common passages which we read is from the second chapter, the last, some of the last verses of the second chapter, Surah Al-Baqarah, that's the second chapter. If those of you have the Quran, if you can even go on online and check this out right now. Towards the last two verses, it says, لَا نُفَرَّقُ بَيْنَ أَحَدٍ مِّن رُسُلِي. God says, believers, tell this to people, that we do not distinction between any of God's prophets. They are all equal. We believe in all of them. They all hold a very high status with God. So what's special about Muhammad? Well, what's special about Muhammad is that he, in our worldview, in our belief system, is the last and the final messenger and prophet of God. The final prophet of God in the line of, in the same line of prophets, starting from Adam all the way to Jesus in our worldview, who again is a prophet of God.
Okay. Another question along the lines of holy books. So share briefly what you believe about the Gospels, the Torah, just very briefly about these other books that influence Islam thought and theology.
Yes. Okay, so what Muslims believe, once again, we have the prophets, right? Moses is a prophet. Let me mention one thing and then I'll answer the question. So Muslims believe that the original message of God throughout history has been one. So in other words, God did not reveal a separate religion throughout the ages. He did not reveal a religion to Buddhists and a different religion to the Confucianists and a different religion to the Taoists and a different religion to the children of Israel and a different religion after the coming of Jesus Christ. Peace be upon him. But rather it was one religion. And that one religion was, its essential lies in two points. Believe in the prophet who is sent to you. Whoever is the prophet who has come to you at your time, who's addressing you, and worship God. This was the essence of the prophetic message throughout the ages. Keeping this in mind, Moses is a prophet of God. And in Muslim worldview, he did not bring Judaism, a religion called Judaism. But rather he brought a religion, the universal religion. Of course, at this time, there's no Muhammad, right? So there's no Sharia fear, there's none of that stuff. This is just, you know, back then. There is, and his message is, believe in me. I'm God's spokesperson. I bring revelation, I bring messages from God in the form of the book called Torah. And you're required to follow me and worship God alone. And his message is brought to the people through Torah. And Muslims believe the same thing happened with Jesus. He's a prophet of God sent to the children of Israel, to the Hebrews. And he is a prophet and his message is believe in me, again, as a prophet of God. and worship God alone. And his message, his revelation is contained, according to Muslims, or was given to people at that time in a book, or should I say the book, okay, just to emphasize it, called the Gospel. Okay, and then later, in Arabic, it's called Injil, Gospel being, you know, the good news. So Muslims believe that it was later that the Gospel was written by different people, including, you know, the disciples, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. And there were actually other Gospels as well, which did not make the official Gospel known as the canon for various reasons. So these Gospels are known as the canonized Gospels, which were officially accepted by the church. And there are other Gospels. Some of them were written actually before these Gospels and also attributed to other disciples, the most famous one being the Gospel of Thomas. Anybody heard the disciple Thomas, right? So there is actually a gospel which talks about the early days of Jesus from his birth up to like 5 years. Some of the miracles which he performed at that time and other things. And some of those miracles which are found in the Gospel of Thomas are found in the Quran. For example, Jesus blowing a spirit into birds of clay and they becoming alive and flying. So some of those which miracles are not found in the canonical gospels in the present day Bible. They are found in the Gospel of Infancy or the Gospel of Thomas. They are found even in the Quran as well. So Muslims believe that the later Gospels, the Gospels which got canonized and then got translated, they consist of three types of words or three types of speech. They have translations, because the very original Gospel in their original languages, we believe, do not exist. So what it contains is translations of the original book, the mother book. Okay, just to give you an example, like a mothership. It's the mother book, the Gospel which Jesus brought. Just like the Torah which Moses brought. Just like the Quran which Muhammad, the peace be upon all of them, which he brought. So it contained translations in Greek and Latin, the Vulgate, the Septuagint, and the other books which were later formulated. Words of the disciples and words of the scribes, which were not words of even the disciples or Jesus. And that's what formed the Gospel, and that's what got transmitted. This is how Muslims view it.
Okay, so one of the things that I think has been most enlightening for our people, as we've talked in this series, is the high view that Muslims have of Jesus as a prophet. And I just even noticed you're talking, which is a common thing when you refer to prophets, peace be upon them. And so I noticed as you said the name Jesus, you said peace be upon him. And so just very quickly, because we'll probably come back to this, but your view of Jesus is very high as a prophet.
Absolutely. I mean, we don't believe in Jesus just as a prophet. Okay, like Jeremiah, for example, or like Isaiah, for instance. He's not just a prophet. He's a very special prophet. As a matter of fact, he is in some ways more than a prophet. He is considered the Messiah. Okay, now when I use the word Messiah, sometimes Christians, and this was one of the questions which was sent, well, okay, if you consider him the Messiah, then why don't you believe he's the Son of God? Because the word Messiah and Son of God are almost synonymous in the minds of most Christians, right? So whenever you say Messiah, most Christians think, okay, that is the Son of God, that's it. Like, they're not two different things. But if you go back in history, as a matter of fact, you can talk to Jews. You don't even have to go back to history. It's very contemporary. You can talk to Jews today. They are still awaiting the Messiah, right? We all know that, right? The Jews are still awaiting the Messiah. And if you ask the Jews of today, they are not awaiting a Son of God to come. And in their mind, if the Jews today will tell you, God does not have a son. This is what the Jews will say. This was what the Jews said back then. If any of you watch the series, Bible, on the History Channel, right? Or did you watch the movie? Which one was it? The recent movie which they made on Jesus.
A.D.
I'm sorry, which one was
A.D.
it?
A.D. or there's the Son of God.
Son of God. They took that part out of the documentary Bible. So what they show in there is the same concept that the Jewish rabbis at that time who did not accept him, this is what they show in that movie, they believe that what he was claiming is not what they are awaiting for. They are not awaiting the appearance of a Son of God, but they are awaiting the appearance of a Messiah. And they still believe today that a Messiah will come. So then comes the question, so in the Muslims, to the Muslims, the Messiah has come, unlike the Jews. The Messiah has come. The question is, okay, what does the word Messiah mean then? Muslims. What does the word mean? If it does not mean the Son of God, which, by the way, in Hebrew, it also doesn't mean the Son of God. What does the word Messiah mean then in Arabic? Because the word appears Isa al-Masih. The Arabic word for Messiah is al-Masih. It means the one who, it has two different meanings. One who is anointed. And I think I have to tell you what that means. Everybody knows what that refers to. And the second thing what it means is someone who miraculously, if you would rub on someone, touching them, wipe on someone, they would be miraculously healed. He had this healing power, this power to perform miracles in the name of God, to convince people that he is a true voice, a true spokesperson, and a true prophet who speaks in the name of God. And he can perform these miracles. They can't be denied. Nobody can question them. So he's known, this is the meaning of the word Messiah, the anointed one. And the second meaning being the one who would wipe, al-mas in Arabic, who would wipe over people who were sick or ill or diseased, and the diseases will go away, like, you know, his curing of the leper and many other people, which are in the Bible, and many of those miracles are also mentioned in the Quran as well.
Okay. When we go to, I want to talk about Ishmael. We had some questions about Ishmael. Right. So in the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures, you know, we just read briefly about Ishmael and about his sons, and then basically he falls off the map in the Hebrew Bible and in the Christian Bible. Obviously, you have a history of Ishmael, so can you talk a little bit about, because even today, a lot of the divide between Jews and Muslims would go back to the Ishmael and Isaac and those two sons. And so can you talk a little bit about your teachings record events and family lineage from Ishmael's death to the birth of Muhammad? Can you talk a little bit about where we can read those things and what it says about that?
Okay, I'll mention just a few points about Ishmael, and then I'll refer you to a book. The book is Abraham, the Friend of God. It's written by an ordained deacon in the United Methodist Church. His name is Dr. Gerald Dirks, with a J, J-E-R-A-L-D, and his last name is Dirks, D-I-R-K-S, and I believe you can find this book on Amazon.com. It's fairly easily available. Abraham, the Friend of God. So what Dr. Gerald Dirks does over there is he recounts the story of Abraham and his children, and he reconstructs the events both from the Bible as well as the Muslim tradition, including the Quran. Because in the Bible, Ishmael kind of just goes into the wilderness and that's the end of it. The Bible doesn't talk a whole lot about Ishmael. It talks a whole lot about Isaac. Isaac being the forefather of the Jews, the Hebrew tribes. The Quran picks up the story where kind of the Bible leaves off. And that's what he tries to bring together and combine the narrative together. So according to the Quran, Ishmael went with his mother, Hagar, to the Arabian Peninsula, which is today known as the Saudi Arabia. And he settled at that time in a land which was barren. It was arid. There was no vegetation. There was nothing there. Today, that city is known as Mecca. It's the holiest and the most sacred place to Muslims. He settled over there. Abraham left Hagar and Ishmael to live over there. There is a tribe, now all of this is from Muslim traditions, there is a tribe, I don't know if the name matters, its name is Jurhum. They're the first ones who spoke Arabic. They are passing by there, they see these people, water has already gushed forth, and that's how the mother and the son survive, because this is desert, there's no people living over there at that time. They just have water over there. And Muslims believe we still drink that water. It's known as the water of Zamzam. So when we go and perform pilgrimage, you know, we still drink that water, and you know, it's a tradition for Muslims to bring that water back. It's considered there's a certain holiness to that water. So the tribe of Jurhum, they are wanderers. When they see this water source over there, they settle in this land known back at that time as Bakka. And I believe also in the Bible it refers to Makkah a few times as Bakka. And later, and the name gets changed from Bakka to Makkah. Over here, he marries one of their daughters, and from there starts their lineage. So Arabs, I'm not Arab, by the way, and all Muslims are not Arabs, and it's a very big mistake to equate Islam with Arabs. Okay, most of the Muslims are not Arabs. But the Arabs, they trace their lineage back to Ishmael and the tribe of Jurhum. That's where they go back to. And from Ishmael, they go back to Abraham. I think one of the best sources for the story, as well as, you know, it has nice charts and it has all the biblical references and references from the Old Testament, the New Testament, and some of the writings of the early church fathers, as well as from Muslim sources, is that book by Dr. Gerald Dirks, Abraham, the Friend of God. He also has another very good book called Understanding Islam. And he has written that book primarily for a Christian audience. So he's assuming that you're a very well-read, very knowledgeable Christian, and he's writing the book over there for that audience. So that would be another book which I will also suggest, Understanding Islam by Dr. Gerald Dirks.
Okay. So we've thrown you a couple softballs.
Hard
ones. That's right. Yeah. We're going to pitch a couple of fastballs here. So, okay, one, let's get into some of the more practical things that really, when we really get down to a lot of things that make people scared, a lot of the assumptions that cause Christians to stay away from Muslims and Muslims to feel intimidated sometimes by Christians. Let me just ask you a couple of these that for you may be simple, but for us, they're not. So,
sure.
Do you want to make criticism of Muhammad or Islam illegal? And if so, what should be the punishment? Should there be punishment? What should the just punishment be for this kind of criticism according to the Quran?
Sure.
So do you want to make that illegal for people to criticize Muhammad or Islam? And what does the Quran say about that?
Good question. But I don't think it's that hard.
Good.
There is nothing wrong with criticism. Prophet Muhammad was criticized in his life. The criticisms of people who rejected his message is recorded in the Quran abundantly and clearly. Even after his life, you know, people criticized, and they gave reasons why they don't believe in him or whatever they find objectionable. So criticism has never been an issue. And even in his life, he forgave people, even those people who hurt him. Those people who, for example, killed his relatives, he forgave them. This is our recorded history. This is what we believe. He did not seek vengeance for those actions. So criticism has a very rich tradition within Muslims, and it is nothing that is frowned upon at all. But what is wrong is Islamophobia. So I want to make sure that we understand different issues. We separate them and we understand them clearly. Criticizing Prophet Muhammad, saying, you know, whatever, I don't believe in him, A, B, C, D, E. And it's criticism, that's all what it is. But I don't like Islam, or I don't believe in Islam, I don't believe it's a true religion, ABC. That's one thing. There's absolutely no problem with that. We engage in dialogue, we talk, we discuss it. You don't have to make it illegal, and obviously, you know, if it's not illegal, there is no question of it being punishable. That would be kind of, you know, very silly. The issue is Islamophobia. Okay, what is Islamophobia? Islamophobia is what leads us. It is an unrealistic and unnatural fear of Islam and Muslims. That's the working definition of Islamophobia. Okay, that somehow Muslims can't be trusted. We don't really know if we can trust this guy. We don't really know if I can trust this person sitting next to me. We don't really know if they are hiding their faith just because they want to appear good. Or do they mean it? What they are saying, they actually mean it. You know, can they be trusted? Maybe they have a hidden agenda of bringing Sharia law, ruling all over us. Okay. So it is this fear of not knowing Muslims, not knowing anything about Muslims. As a matter of fact, I have not met a single person who's Islamophobic who has actually known Muslims or lived in a Muslim country. And there are quite a few Christians like that, either on missions or for different jobs or businesses in UAE, in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, teaching in universities, in Egypt, in Morocco. I've met a whole lot of Christians, and they absolutely see this whole idea as ridiculous, you know, of like having this fear of Muslims that they somehow are out there to get us or to, you know, wipe off the civilization because of this idea of, you know, Samuel Huntington is a Harvard professor who wrote this book, Clash of Civilizations. And over there he said that the Western civilization, this is where the root of some of this goes back to. He said that the Western civilization is on a clash collision course with several civilizations. One of those were the Chinese and the Japanese. So he put all of them together, okay? And he predicted what United States should do in the next 20 years in order to, you know, not, you know, be overcome by them. And another civilization which he wrote over there was the Islamic civilization. So from there came this idea of that the Muslims and the West are somehow on a collision course, and there is no way to reconcile them. There are several Muslim majority countries who have been part of the Islamophobia that there was genocide over there. Do you remember what is the name of the country? Anybody? Oh no, this is very recent. Spain, yes, you're absolutely correct, but that goes about 800 years ago. I'm talking about a very recent country in the 90s. Bosnia. So Bosnia is one of those countries where Muslims have lived over there for hundreds of years. This is part of the European Union. This is Europe. This is EU. But because of this fear, the Serbs and you know, other people over there, they practiced genocide. So hundreds of thousands of Muslims were killed over a war, you know, which made absolutely no sense. And that's not the only one. Recently, and I know there is a question over here also about you know, Muslims stand these issues for what they are. There have been killings taking place on both sides, unfortunately, throughout history. Till today. So for example, right now in Nigeria, Muslims have killed Christians, and Christians have killed Muslims. And there is another country in Africa, quite recently, Central African Republic. The whole country has about under 1,000 mosques, and more than 600 mosques have been destroyed by people who claim to be Christians. And there have been other acts of atrocities in ISIS, everybody knows that, by people claiming to follow Islam against Christians. So this stuff has been going on. But this does not have to do with the teaching of Islam or Christianity. This has to do mostly with politics and people, vulnerable people, who do not have any hope, being exploited by local politicians and power factions on both sides. On both sides. It takes different forms in different parts of the world. In India, it's different. Muslims are 1.6 billion. They are all not the same. So Muslims in North America, they are very different in their economic status, in their understanding, in the type of jobs and professions they have. In India, they are different. In Europe, they are different. In China, they are different. In Russia, they are different. And there are millions of Muslims all over, in all of these countries that I have mentioned. So Islamophobia, this fear of Muslims, needs to be treated, and the writings which take place as a result of that, and the commentary which takes place, it should be treated like anti-Semitism, as well as hate speech. Someone might say, well, if you actually, you know, explore the idea of free speech, you will see that the reason why anti-Semitism was banned, especially in Europe, in some European countries you get 7 years in prison for denying the Holocaust, for example. The reason why anti-Semitism was banned is because of the violence it generated against Jews. This is the reason why it was made illegal. And the argument over here why Islamophobia needs to be made illegal is because of the violence it has generated in America and in Europe and elsewhere against Muslims. So for example, this last weekend I was in North Carolina. How many of you heard of the three Muslim students who were killed in North Carolina? They were murdered in their apartment by a man. He came in there, he was a neighbor, and he shot them in the head. That's it. I was in the same mosque where they prayed, the same school where they went to up to eighth grade, and where their funeral prayer was offered. So Muslims are on the side of the receiving end within the United States as well, where they actually are getting killed, and some of it gets media coverage. Not all of it, some of it gets media coverage. At the same time, in Europe, for example, quite recently, in the beginning of this year, in January, 30,000 Germans marched. Three different mosques were burned, grenades were thrown in it, and they were shot at. All of this is like around December last year and January this year, events. This is when this is taking place. So, and we have, of course, wars which have taken place, you know, and within the European context as well, where Muslims are treated as an ethnic group, and there is a call to wipe them off, to remove them from the face of the planet. So the violence has been generated, and the hateful rhetoric, Islamophobia, has to be tempered down. And you know, we need to engage in speech, in criticism, in academic discussion, not in fear-mongering and spreading hate.
Okay, so I'm gonna push back a little bit on this. Sure. In a sense. Let me just start with this. So you have Islamic countries that will not allow people to, Christians, to evangelize or speak of their faith publicly.
Sure.
So do you find, so as you say that you're trying to stop Islamophobia, you know, not speaking out violence, so what do you think about those Islamic countries that do not permit free speech for Christians to be able to articulate their faith publicly?
Yeah, okay. So what I'm talking about is the violence committed, okay. Right? So I'm talking about the violence which is committed because this type of speech leads to violence. And I gave examples of this type of speech leading to violence. Any type of speech which leads to violence should be controlled, okay? Because it leads to violence. There should be no room for that violence, whether it's against Christians or Hindus or Muslims or Jews, anybody, or blacks.
Right, but how do you define when that speech is criticism, when it is sarcasm,
sure.
when it is hate speech? So when you see like, and I'm not justifying this at all,
sure.
but I'm saying like, so for example, Rushdie or whatever, who wrote the novel in Iran several years ago and was threatened by people because he wrote the novel that he wrote. Or you look at what recently happened in France, where you had a newspaper that was making disrespectful, but just parody comedy that I would not endorse, but still, and then you find there was a response against that was very violent. So talk a little bit more, because I think this is a longer conversation, but where are those lines between people that are making fair criticism and having the freedom to criticize or disagree, or people that is between saying this becomes Islamophobia?
Right. I think, you know, we can go back to the same guidelines that people have set for anti-Semitism, okay? And for example, as a Christian, you would be able to understand, let's take the example of Charlie Hebdo, right? The cartoons which were produced in France. The same magazine, and again, first, before I even say that, the killing which took place is that's not what the religion sanctions, that's not what any sensible Muslim would ever do or like or approve of in their right mind, okay? It's senseless, it's tragic, it's absolutely wrong. There is no room for it whatsoever, okay? At the same time, we have to understand, and I'm not saying this what I'm going to call. What I'm saying is not a justification. Like, oh yeah, well, they did this, but there is no but. That's an unconditional statement, what I just said. The same magazine, but over here, so what I'm talking about is not the action of the violent action which took place. What over here I'm doing is trying to show you how Islamophobia, that's what I'm trying to talk about. The same magazine fired another cartoonist a few years ago for making anti-Semitic cartoons. The same magazine. They fired a cartoonist. But it was okay to make fun of Muslims, ridicule, and you know, put it in the cartoons, and to do what the whole thing which they did. At the other side, the Roman Catholic Church sued a clothing company in France because they were making some very offensive clothing ads to my friend. Is they had actually a picture of the Last Supper of Christ, except that there were all these young models without clothes, and you know they were holding the you know the cup, and you know the Jesus was like in a form of a naked woman. She was laying down, and everybody else was naked. It was very offensive to the Catholic Church. They took this the ad company, the marketing company, as well as the clothing company to court, and the judge ruled that it has to be stopped. And one of the arguments given, this is on BBC, you can search for it right now. You can go to search BBC and you know throw in some of the keywords and you will see this news article in there. It was reported in the BBC. The lawyer for the Roman Catholic Church at that time made some very interesting comments. And he said that there are certain symbols of every religion which are sacred. And to attack them is not an exercise of free speech. And he's talking about Christians. They are in the majority, okay? Some of the examples which he gave is, for example, putting the cross on an underwear or making a picture of, you know, Jesus, you know, the crucifix, for example, on socks or on condoms. Very offensive stuff. This is the argument the attorney for the Roman Catholic Church made, telling the judge why these types of things should not be allowed. And the judge, the French judge, agreed with him. I'll give you a third example. Last year, you know, events took place in Palestine. There were some about 2,000, you know, three Jewish students were killed. After that, you know, Israel invaded Gaza, and there were about 2,000 Palestinians who were killed, and, you know, billions of dollars of damage which took place. France became the only country in the whole world to ban, last summer, pro-Palestinian demonstrations. You cannot demonstrate. You cannot demonstrate in support of Palestine or what's taking place over there. So these are some examples where, you know, it's very clear that when you're making fun of a religion or what's sacred to a religion in the most offensive way, not to get attention, but to sell for corporate profit. Even the Pope did not agree with the Charlie Hebdo cartoons and some of the other cartoonists in France as well. Some very notable Japanese cartoonists, they also said that this is not free speech. This is not the free speech which we as cartoonists want or want to propagate.
So to say that, so what you're articulating, and obviously you don't speak for all Muslim groups or anything. But to say that, does the Quran forbid? So when you have countries that forbid saying anything negative or critical, is that more based on Quran verses, or is that more a governmental or a social dictate that's put that says if you criticize the Quran or the Prophet, whatever, you're going to be arrested?
What I do know is that in some places, you spoke before about, you know, evangelizing, Christians evangelizing. They do this in Egypt. I've seen them myself. They do this in Morocco. They do this in Pakistan. All three are Muslim countries. They are allowed to do that. They are not doing this underground. So there are Muslim countries where, for example, Christians can come and spread the message, and they are allowed to do that. There are other countries where they are not allowed to do that. And most notably, Saudi Arabia. That's, I believe, the only country where they are not allowed to do that. There might be a few other, but that's the one that I know of. So it's not like Christians in any Muslim country, in Turkey, again, same thing. They are allowed to go and, you know, evangelize and, you know, engage in evangelizing. So many of these things are allowed in parts of the Muslim world and not in other parts. Obviously, this goes back to the government policy, how the government views it and, what they allow and what they don't allow. One point which I want to make is whenever you talk about this issue of Christians being able to or allowed to evangelize, you need to know just a little bit about history. How many of you know about colonialism?
What's that?
Colonialism.
Colonialism, oh yeah.
Okay. Most of the Muslim world, with the exception of Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, were colonized. And they were colonized by primarily Christian powers. The British, the German, the Dutch, the Italians. They are the ones who colonized all these places. And when they colonized it, they spread Christianity. So at one hand, they came and they used military power. And on the other hand, they came with the Bible. Okay? So you may not read about that in, like, you know, American history or US government, right, which is required reading in our public schools, even in colleges. But in these Muslim countries, this is part of standard curriculum. People know about it. This is their history, and they are familiar with their history. They understand their history. So they view evangelical Christians, when they come, as an onslaught. And this is what Abraham Muhlenberg referred to last week as well. He spoke about this as well, that you need to kind of understand, you know, how people are perceived because of what happened in the past. This is what he was referring to. So there is the history of colonialism which goes back. So you should understand it in that context.
So even though in our mind we separate colonialism from the gospel,
right?
But in their mind they say, well, when these people came from Germany, whatever, and they colonized us, they put Christianity and the colonization in the same view.
Yes. I mean, that's when, you know, for example, they established a lot of the churches.
Yes.
And, you know, right, they did a lot of that work at that time.
Okay, so one more thing about this, and then we're going to, just very quick answer.
Sure.
Does the Quran justify punishment against people that criticize Muhammad?
No, it doesn't. No.
Okay, so that's,
I mean, the Quran actually records, you know, criticism against Muhammad and Islam itself.
Okay. On the idea of persecution, this is a little a lengthier response, but someone did their homework, so I want to read this.
Sure.
So according to Matthew 5:10, Jesus said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs the kingdom of heaven." Is this consistent with the Quran recounting of Jesus' teachings about blessed are those who are persecuted? And how does it fit with Surah 2:191 that says, "And slay them wherever ye find them, and drive them out of the places whence they drove you out, for persecution is worse than slaughter." And then in 2:193 it says, "And fight them until persecution is no more, and religion is for Allah." So there's a longer question there, but do most Muslims, are they consistent with Jesus' view of blessed are those who are persecuted, which sounds good on paper. Most Christians don't really want to live that or want to practically believe that. But so I guess really the heart of this is these verses in the Quran that speaks about slay them wherever you find them, drive them out from the place. Persecution is worse than slaughter, and fight them until persecution is no more, and religion is for Allah.
Right. Okay, so these verses is what I will say are the closest to what is considered the violent verses. Okay. If you have cell phones or your gadgets, what I would like you to do is go back This is Quran, second chapter, verse 191 and 193. The verses which he read, they are 191 and 193. Read about two or three verses before that and a couple of verses after that. So you can do that right now. What you will see is that they are not talking. This is not a general command. So over here, in other words, the Quran is not saying, and slay them, meaning non-Muslims, wherever you find them. So this means come to the United States or go to Europe or go to Australia or go to India and go to China and go start killing people. It was never understood like that. That's not what it is saying. This is talking in a context of self-defense. So, and the same goes for the Bible. Okay, there are verses in the Bible as well which have to be read in this context. So the Quran has history in it, and these verses are talking about the historical events which took place at that time, and people are being told who were attacked, they were killed, their wealth was taken away from them, that now is the time for you to bear arms and to defend yourself. And it is over here that it is talking about the sacred precincts in Mecca, where war was about to break, to take place, where Muslims were told to pick up their arms and to fight. This is not the time right now to sit and get decimated, but it is time right now for you to defend yourselves. It is in that context that these verses were revealed. And as I said, you can look at the context, and even without knowing the detailed commentary or the historical context, just by reading the verses before and after, you'll have a better understanding of the context of these verses. This is second chapter, and both of them are from the same, they're very close, 191 and 193.
Yes.
But they're just small sections of the verse. It's not even the whole verse. So please do refer to it.
Yes. Very important for those of us that are Christians that have friends who forward blogs to us, or you read things about these violent verses in the Quran. It's very important, if you really want to know what it says, it's very important to take a little bit of time and actually pull it up. You can do it on the internet and read the context of those verses. It's no doubt that if we take verses out of context and just them, for example, Jesus said, "I have not come to bring peace, but I've come to bring a sword." Jesus said those words. Now, if you take those words out of context, they can be used to take naive people that do not know anything about the Bible, who don't read the Bible, who don't have a personal relationship with Christ or with God, the Father, that they can take that verse, and you can use that verse to manipulate people to say, in the name of Jesus, he said, "I've not come to bring peace, but bring a sword." What he's talking about in the context is that when people convert and follow him, it will lead to persecution, rejection among your family, etc. And so you have to contextualize verses, and we do it in the Bible very naturally because that's what we're familiar with. And I would say that most Muslims also understand those verses in that context, but unfortunately, extremists take those verses out of context to manipulate people. And also, when we hear Christians responding about those verses, we're not given the context, we're just given the Quran teaches this, correct?
Right. So, I mean, for example, the Quran also teaches don't pray. You know, the prayer is one of the pillars of Islamic practice, right? Everybody knows that, right? It's one of the five pillars of what Muslims practice. There's a verse in the Quran which says don't pray. There is. There actually is a verse in the Quran which says don't pray. But the verse after that says don't pray when you're in a state of drunkenness, when you are drunk. But it actually does say that. So you can use that verse and say, look, these Muslims, they don't pray, you know. They're all lying. They're all lying that they're all, you know, praying, and they want to appear like, you know, Christians. They all want to like sound like, you know, we are all loving and we give charity. Their scripture says, do not pray.
Yeah, well, you know what? I can beat that because the Bible says there is no God.
All right. Okay.
It says very clearly there's no God. Psalm 14:1, the fool says in his heart there is no God, right?
All right. Okay.
So we have to take it. So, yeah. But I'll remember that next time I'm drunk, that I'll remember that I need to be careful and just hold off till I sober up. Okay. Very good. Along these lines, let's talk about this idea of jihad.
Sure.
And so, obviously, that's a word that we hear a lot. The word means to struggle, and so, I actually had people that have said to me, "Well, Jim, I know this, and I've been to Muslim countries. I know Muslims. This idea that you would say jihad is an inner struggle, and of course, people who the extremists that would take violence against others use jihad as an external struggle against forces or against powers. So can you talk a little bit about this and try to give us sort of a brief summary of this, and then I've got some follow-up questions around that.
Sure. Well, the concept of jihad, the word jihad in Arabic comes from the word al-juhud, which means to struggle, to put an effort. That's what it means. There is a military component to it. Okay. So Islam is not a pacifist religion. Okay. So Islam doesn't. It's not a religion which says that you can never bear arms. If you're attacked, you should lay down your arms and let your enemy kill you. It doesn't teach that. The religion does not have that teaching. And that's why you find those verses which were just quoted. Okay. It does teach self-defense. And it does lay down rules of conduct in war. For example, you should only attack when you are attacked. This is one of the rules. There are several others. I won't mention all of them. This is one of them. You should only attack when you are attacked. Okay. You should fight in self-defense. So this is one of those rules. Another thing is that your attack should be proportional. It should not be out of proportion. Okay. So if let's say there is one attack, with conventional weapons, you don't drop atomic bombs and wipe off the whole country from the planet. That's disproportionate. That's another one of the rules. So there are several rules like this which are documented, which are very well known among the Muslim scholars. But that's just a very small part of what jihad is. Jihad is actually the daily struggle to be a Muslim, to purify your intention, to fight against materialism, to pray on time, to give charity even though you love your wealth, but to give it for the love of God and for the love of other human beings, to be helpful. All of these things are considered jihad or a struggle against, myself and what my soul desires, the base desires. That's the broader concept of jihad.
Okay. So what is it like in countries like, I'm just going to throw a couple out, let's say that you are a practicing Muslim, sincere practicing Muslim, and you live in a country like Afghanistan and you have the Taliban or you have, ISIS that are using this external jihad to manipulate, to do violence. What is the context like? Because I know that there are people that in Islamic countries that don't support the Taliban, and there's a lot of Afghans that are not supportive of the Taliban. So in those countries where you find people in the name of Islam or advocating this violence, this physical jihad or violence against others, and they're perpetuating a theology that you would disagree with, that happens in most Islamic countries. Would it happen there? And how do you handle that? I shouldn't say most Islamic countries, but when that happens, what is it like in those countries?
I think there is a lack of Islamic education among Muslims. That's one of the key problems which we have. And one of the things which some countries did is they captured some of these terrorists who were brainwashed, and they put them in a curriculum to study and learn Islam. So that's what they started doing. They actually started teaching them, and they used Islamic clerics, Islamic clergy, Islamic imams to teach them what Islam says and say, okay, this is what your question is. This is how you interpreted it. This is why it is incorrect. This is how it actually should be interpreted. And these are the reasons. Endless discussion. They will be available. They'll be over there and they will talk to you and they will answer your questions and they will engage with you. That's what they did. And it worked in many cases. And those people, many of those people, they changed their ideas. As a matter of fact, some of them came out and wrote books saying, I found the way or something.
So what percentage? So there's a lot of people in Islamic, predominantly Islamic countries, that are being taught a form of Islam without even really knowing what the Quran says. They're just following what they're being taught, correct?
And I won't say a lot. I think it's a very small minority.
Okay.
The people who are doing this are a very small minority, and there are different groups, like Pew and Gallup, which have done studies, which indicate that the people who are extremists are an extremely small minority. They have different percentages, less than 1% or something like this, out of 1.6 billion. They are the ones who aspire this type of, or hold violent ideas and terrorist ideas. And I believe that, the way to correct it is through education.
Right. And how do most Muslims in those countries, when they encounter those extremist views that would not be in line with how you understand and teach jihad, is that confronted?
Sometimes they are punished, there are some very strict laws, some people who have committed crimes, they are punished. Those who are kind of, on the path of radicalization, they are taught and they are educated. So there are programs and there are laws to handle this type of extremism.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So as you say that, let me just, I'm going to think out loud here and I'm not sure that I'm right. So So, for example, countries like the Taliban is very well known or very influential. So, is the Taliban, is it all bad, or is there just segments of the Taliban that are bad because they're permitted to sort of have a lot of authority in certain countries?
At this point, this is what I know of Afghanistan. I haven't followed the news of Afghanistan for a while. It's pretty much a lawless country at this point. It has been since the Soviets came in the late 70s. It has been a country without effective government. The Taliban came in, they ruled for a few years, they had a semblance of government, and after that they went out. And since then, there is very limited governance over there, very limited infrastructure over there, very limited basic facilities, education, hospitals, very little to give people hope. So there is not really a whole lot of, you know, things happening over there which can control those people. So what countries like that need is, you know, a functional government.
Okay.
But especially Afghanistan. Another country which is also in the same shape is Somalia. That's also a country where there is not a functional government at this point.
Okay. How about, so let's talk about, let's go into a couple of areas that I've had a lot of people ask questions about, which is Sharia law and also women. So as we're talking a little bit about governments, is Sharia law found in the Quran, and what parts of Sharia law are not?
Okay. Well, first of all, Sharia, the word Sharia is misunderstood, perhaps the second most misunderstood word after jihad. What does it mean? That's the question. What is Sharia law? I think the best way to understand is to compare it to the Jewish halakha law and to the Catholic canon law, the law of the church, of the Catholic Church. But a more accurate comparison will be with the Jewish law, which the Orthodox Jews follow. That would be really the closest comparison. Sharia basically is not a set of rules or a set of laws. That's not what Sharia is. There is another word for that. That's fiqh. It's something different. Sharia is basically a set, a code of ethics, which is, you can think of it as, the Sharia is, this is what how Muslims view Sharia. Muslim scholars, I would say. Because if you ask most average Muslims, they will not be able to tell you what is Sharia. It is a set of, a code of ethics, which have to do with, for example, justice, which has to do with moderation, which has to do with, sort of think of it like this, as the unchanging law of God, or the unchanging teachings of God, a humane treatment of others. It's general guidelines. That's what Sharia is. Okay, it's a set of instructions from God. That's what Sharia is. Examples of what Sharia law would be: the way Muslims, for example, bury their dead. You know, the burial procedures, just like the Jewish halakha law, for example, the dietary law of the Muslims, for instance, just like the Jewish kosher law. Okay, so there are many other examples like this, where Sharia is comparable to the Jewish halakha law, family law as well. Okay, some issues of, like, you know, marriage and divorce, and this is over here. You know, there is Sharia law is similar to the Catholic law, because, you know, Catholics, they can divorce, right? The marriage has to be annulled. This is a result of the Catholic Church law, the canon law. So Sharia has, like, you can think of it as it has some elements of these different types of practices. There is no concept. Okay, I can tell you. Look, I spoke about jihad, right? And I told you Islam is not a pacifist religion. There are teachings of war in Quran, right? I told you that. There is no call whatsoever that I know of, that I've ever heard, of implementing Sharia in America or in Europe or anywhere in the West. The whole idea is ridiculous. It's nothing but plain and simple fear-mongering. It's picking up a strange word, just like picking up Allah and saying, it's a foreign God, you gotta be scared. You gotta be scared. You don't really know what is Allah. You know, your Christian Jewish friends, I mean, your Arab Jewish friends, about 12 billion of them, Abraham quoted the correct number last week, and the Christian, Arab Christians, they refer to the God as Allah. It's not a foreign God. But the word was picked up to create fear. And then after that, they picked up another word, jihad. Jihad. It's out there to, you know, wipe us off. And then came another word, Sharia law. Muslims are out there to put this law. How in the world can 6 million the highest is 11, between 6 to 11 million Muslims in North America bring a law called Sharia law to rule the United States. I mean, just, I want you to kind of take Fox News out and Sean Hannity out and all those things out of your mind. How in the world, I mean, just think, how could that happen? Like what? It's because of this fear mongering that every fourth American thinks that Obama is a Muslim. He's not, he's a Christian. He goes to church with his wife. He prays in church. He has a pastor that he goes to. He's a Christian, a church-going Christian. A liberal Christian, but he's a church-going Christian. But once you know this fear was created because it ties with politics, it's very easy now to demonize someone. I read a news in the last 1 week. A police chief in Maryland, an African-American lady, I forget if she's a police chief or a city council woman, she got elected and nominated to some office in the city. And the news, one of the news medias, you know, channels, they came out and they said, she needs to say if she is a Muslim or not, so we know if we can trust her. You know, so basically right now, if you want to, you know, discredit someone, throw the idea, Muslim in the closet. But there is no such thing. One of the fundamentals of Sharia, it does not address people who don't believe in Islam. It has nothing to do with those people who don't believe in Islam. Even when Muslims, when Muslims used to rule different parts of the world in history, non-Muslims, I'm telling you facts, these are academic facts, okay? Non-Muslims for the most part had the ability to rule themselves by their own laws. And this especially is important, for example, in cases of marriage and divorce. They can judge their own issues based on whatever their traditions are, whatever their laws are. They can settle their disputes according to that. Sharia was not applied to them. Islamic law was not applied to settle their disputes. They were free to settle their disputes in their own way, whatever they have inherited or whatever they have taken from the previous
time. So Sharia is in the Quran?
Sharia is in the Quran. How can I answer that? It's like saying, is halakha law in the Torah?
Okay, so it doesn't specifically prescribe in the Quran, doesn't say this is the definition of Sharia law. So it's sort of the term that says these bunch of laws that we value.
Guidelines.
Guidelines are non-negotiables for a Muslim. These are sort of our, okay.
Yes.
And then what happens is that if someone takes that, so a lot of the fear in America is a misunderstanding that this is a whole way of governing an entire country or land.
Okay.
Is that true?
There are, in the past, people apply different aspects. Let me mention this. In politics, right, Sharia never gave a set line of this is how the government has to be ruled. Most of it is left up to people. Okay. As a matter of fact, we have a concept which is contained in the Quran, scholars explained it, what is known as shura. It means mutual consultation. And the way Muslims, Islamic centers, they run, is they pick this word up from the Quran. It's a very democratic process, known as shura or consultation, and they applied it to our Islamic centers. So Islamic centers in North America, they are run based on this Sharia word called shura or consultation, which is a very democratic process based on which people get elected. And there is a term. So you can think of it as something which leaves a lot of those issues of governance up to the people. They can go figure out and do whatever they want to do with it.
Well, and I'd say this as well, that, you know, as you've rightly said, the Catholic Church for several hundred years, you know, they would do the services in Latin. People didn't know what was being said, and the Catholic Church was able to use that to in some ways guide people into beliefs that were inconsistent with the scriptures. Even I think when you find those of you that are Christians concerned about Sharia, I'm not making this... It just would be interesting for you to do a Google search on the Geneva Society. When you had a guy named John Calvin who tried to implement a Christian form of governance upon Geneva, and what happened was the rules and laws that they began to implement, where you also had people that were put to death for really crazy things. People could be arrested for not attending church. Whenever you try to take fundamental laws within a religion, even though we have histories in Christianity like Geneva Society, you know, people tend to take it too far. They tend to go crazy. You're always going to have those extreme applications of that. And I think that when we hear, as Americans and Christians, Sharia law, we have to understand that that same thing, those extreme things are maybe brought to us, but it's not reflective of.
Right. So you see, what happens is, like, acts of terrorism are equated to jihad, right? And now jihad is an Islamic concept, and acts of terrorism are called jihad. Now, obviously, anyone in their right mind are going to, you know, get scared. Anybody would be scared. In the same way, for example, acts of genital mutilation or acts of honor killings or other some horrendous acts of violence, they are equated with, oh, this is Sharia law in practice. That's what Sharia law does. Obviously, you're going to hate Sharia law, and you're going to hate Islam, and you're going to hate Muslims, because, hey, Sharia law has to do with Islam. So Sharia is not something independent or outside of Islam. You can think of Sharia as instructions, Islamic teachings. It is not, it is teachings which are teachings of compassion. So when we talk about compassion, when I'm talking right now, sitting over here, what I'm doing, I want to use Sharia law, but when I'm drinking water with my right hand, I'm implementing Sharia. When I make wudu to clean myself, to pray like Jesus prayed in the Bible, I'm implementing Sharia. If I'm trying to be kind to someone, I'm implementing Sharia, the teachings of God. So if you want to strike off the word Sharia, it's the teachings of Islam, the teachings of God.
Right.
That would be the most generic and accurate description, the injunctions of God. So whenever somebody is doing something good, now here is something which I want you to please think about. You cannot judge a teaching, a religion, by people who break it. So you cannot judge. Okay? And I'll give you an example. I gave this example to in another interview. So for example, think about people who live outside of America. You know, sometimes people have difficulty kind of, you know, transporting themselves in that mode, but just think for a moment you're not an American. You're living outside of America. And all you hear is serial killers, rapists. All you hear is some really violent crimes. Really violent crimes. That's all what you see. That's all what your media is showing you. And then they are telling you, America is a country of rapists. It's a country of criminals. And they have the largest rate of incarceration, which is true, by the way. 7 million people. 7 million people are in prison. It's a country of criminals. If that's all what you're seeing, would you be correct in judging America and Americans based on people who break the laws in America? That would be unfair. It's the same people who violate the teachings of Islam, okay, / Sharia, right? I'm just using the words interchangeably. They cannot be used to judge the faith.
I read that the young man that the Boston bomber that mm-hmm. just recently went through trial, he said in one of his depositions, he said, and I quote, the Quran forbids us from killing innocent people, but we felt compelled to do this act, whatever. Right. And so in his own deposition, he was acknowledging that the Quran was definitive in the fact that you should not kill innocent people, but he and his brother felt this higher calling to step into this act of violence that contradicted what is very plainly taught in the Quran.
Yes, absolutely. The teaching that you cannot force religion on others, it's an absolute given in Islam. As a matter of fact, there is a verse in the Quran which says, La ikraha fi din, there is no compulsion in religion. As a matter of fact, by the unanimous agreement of all Muslims throughout history, I don't know of any exception to this. There might be one, I don't know of one. Forcing faith on anyone, their faith is not accepted by God. That's just like a very common sense thing. It's like to force somebody to accept a faith. God does not accept that. And this is the central tenet of Islam, la ikraha fi din. There is no compulsion in religion whatsoever. I want to mention one other point. A lot of people say that, okay, why are these suicide bombings taking place? Why is a lot of this violence and terrorism taking place? And this is what is in their mind. There is a religion, a foreign religion. We have met some people, we have heard some good things here and there. But it is a foreign religion. We don't really understand it, right? Because some people say one thing about it, other people say another thing about it. It talks about jihad, and people of this religion seem to be carrying out, you know, a lot of them seem to be carrying out acts of terrorism, and I see this all the time on my television. And I see these other people, you know, doing horrendous things to Christians or to women or to minorities. The most common reason, the most obvious reason to some people is this is what the religion teaches them. That's why they are committing these acts of terrorism. They are living their faith. These people are living their faith. Maybe they have misunderstood their faith, but they are living their faith. I'll give you two books. They are written by a University of Chicago political science professor, Robert Pape. P-A-P-E. Robert is Robert, P-A-P-E. I would like you to please refer to these two books. He was sanctioned by the United States Department of Defense, United States Navy, and many other government organizations by the Bush administration to conduct the largest study of suicide bombings ever done. He is the expert. This guy, Robert Pape, Dr. Robert Pape, he is considered the expert, and he has two books which he has written. He has documented every single act of terrorism and suicide bombing in the last 25 years in detail and created a database anywhere in the world to try to understand why terrorism is taking place, who's doing it and why it is taking place. I'll give you the two titles which he has written. The first is an earlier book which came out in 2006. It's called Dying to Win: The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. And then he has a newer book, Cutting the Fuse: The Explosion of Global Suicide Terrorism and How to Stop It. Over there you can go, and this is an expert. He's not Muslim, by the way, as far as I know. He never accepted Islam. He's nothing to do with Muslims. He goes there and studies as an academic, as a university professor, why terrorism is taking place, including suicide terrorism, which is its worst form. Why are these people doing what they are doing? One of his conclusions, and he writes down his conclusions, I mean, he got millions of dollars from the government to conduct the study, and we need to know about his research. That's why I'm referring to it. Suicide bombing is not taking place because of religious teachings. That's his conclusion. That's his conclusion, not my conclusion. You can even find his lectures on YouTube. He goes around everywhere lecturing as well in universities. And his lectures are on YouTube as well. And of course, he's way more eloquent presenting his research than I ever can be. The other conclusion which he very strongly propagates is the reason for a lot of the acts of terrorism are political. They have to do with occupation. This is the word he uses. He says they have to do with military occupation and people being treated unjustly and unfairly. This is why these crazy people are doing whatever they are doing. And he has other conclusions as well. I've given you the references. Please, if you get a chance, at least read something about some articles by him, some interviews by him. I think you'll find it very interesting.
Good. Well, we're running short on time, so I want to go very quickly, so we'll try to do some short answers. Let's rapid fire several questions.
Yes, no.
But I want to have a couple, I want to get a couple areas. I want to talk about women, family, and I want to talk about other faiths, okay?
Sure.
So first of all, women, a question here: are women considered second-class citizens compared to men in Islam? And do men have multiple wives?
The answer to first question is no. But if you will insist, my question will be, what does second-class citizen mean? Like, what does that mean, like second-class citizens? Of course, they're not treated as second-class citizens. They are equal citizens. They are equal human beings. As a matter of fact, again, you know, then I'll go in details. In France, a few centuries ago, they were debating whether women have soul. Now, you will not watch this in Hollywood movies. This is a fact. There was a debate in France if women have souls about 100, 150 years ago. Muslims never had that debate. Ever.
Sorry, yeah.
The other question was...
Do men have multiple wives?
Most of them don't. Most of them don't.
Yeah.
No. A word about polygamy. Muslim men, when it's allowed by law, are allowed to have more than one wife. Muslim men. Majority of Muslims do not practice polygamy, even when it is allowed, because usually one wife is...
Enough. That's right. You can say it. Yeah. It's all right. You're safe here.
But I want to point two things out over here. African Christians are more polygamous than Muslims. As a matter of fact, there is a book written by a Catholic missionary encouraging the church to look at their teaching. Again, this is him. I didn't write this. I have nothing to do with this. Okay. He wrote a book telling the church, instructing the Catholic Church, that we need to look at different circumstances of different societies and cultures before we say that it is unchristian to have more than one wife. And that book is also available from Amazon. I don't remember the title right now. And of course, you know the Mormons. Now, you may not consider them Christian, that's fine, or you may consider them Christian, but they consider themselves Christian, and they do believe in polygamy.
So the second class citizen, I would say some things that I think would draw people to that conclusion. So, for example, we hear about countries where women are not given equal education, or in certain countries where women cannot teach or have positions of leadership. Even for most Americans, we look at burqas or the hijab, how do you say it?
Hijab.
Yeah, yeah.
The veiling.
Covering. So a lot of times our perception is that they're being told what they have to wear, how they have to live. In certain countries, they can't have the same equal education or have leadership, etc. So
let me comment on each one of them very quickly. Okay, first of all, we have ladies over here. We have Muslim ladies, including, you know, some of them are physicians, some of them are housewives, some of them work, some of them don't work, who are covered and some who are not covered. After the talk, you're more than welcome to ask them. Does your husband force you to do one or the other? They can speak for themselves, okay? And you can come to our mosque and do the same thing as well, anytime. It's not just these ladies. They weren't handpicked. They came over here of their own free will, okay? They came here of their own free will, and I don't even know who's over here. But you can ask other ladies as well. As a matter of fact, if you see anyone, you can ask them, you know? That was about
the countries.
Covering.
The countries are women.
Education. In most cases, please do understand, it's not a matter of limiting education for women. Men can't have an education. There is not even food to eat. You're talking about the absolute horrendous levels of poverty. And at the same time, you're talking about other countries, like Egypt, where there are more women in colleges and universities than men. That's a fact.
Okay. So what about this, I can't remember the story, this young girl that got a Nobel Peace Prize.
Malala Yousafzai.
Yeah. So
yes, she's a champion of education.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why she got the Nobel Prize, because she champions education for children of the world. She was shot by the Taliban in the head. I wrote an article about her, which got published in the Community World. She is a Muslim, and she says very openly that I am inspired by Islamic values. She says this very clearly. And she's also nonviolent and very peaceful. And she said that even if the Taliban who shot me, the guy, you know, whoever shot me, if he comes in front of me with his gun, I will hit him in the head with the shoe, but I will not hit him, and I will tell him what you're doing is wrong, but I will not kill him. I will not harm him.
Okay. So she will or she won't hit him with the shoe?
No, she won't.
Okay,
no,
she won't. Okay, that's going to be clear.
Yeah, she won't.
Yeah, I just didn't know what kind of shoe she had, if she's going to hurt him or not, so all right.
With a long heel, you know.
That's right, okay. Okay, so as far as the burqa and the hijab, could you just explain that? These are coverings for women. Are they required? If so, why are they required? Do women ever refuse to wear them, etc.?
Sure. You see, Islam is not the only religion where women cover themselves. You find this most notably among Jews. Orthodox Jewish women, for example, they cover themselves. As a matter of fact, they wear wigs to cover their hair. You'll find Christian women who wear hijab. How many of you knew about that?
I didn't know that.
I have met Christian ladies myself. I just didn't take a selfie. I wish I did. But I will. I will. I will. I made a mistake, you know, but I'll go there again. Mennonites. There's a community of Mennonites over here, 1 hour away from here, and they come and visit us all the time. Some of the nicest, most humble people. And they're women, they're Christians. Very opposed to the Catholic Church. They were persecuted about 500 years ago. Down the road, they came and settled over here. And mostly in Illinois, Michigan, and some of the other states. That's where they are settled, the Mennonite Christians. Women still wear hijab. As a matter of fact, if you look at some of them, you will be confused, like, is she Muslim or is she Christian?
Okay. So is it required or just sort of is more cultural?
It is part of the teaching of Islam. It is something which Islam teaches. Now, at the same time, it doesn't mean that that's all that there is to a Muslim woman. That's a very important thing to keep in mind, okay? You can, I mean, a Muslim woman might be doing a lot of other good things, but she may not be observing the veil for whatever her reasons are, okay? But this is not one yardstick to judge if she is Muslim or she's not Muslim. Because some Christians ask me this, what if she's not covering? Is she not Muslim? Of course not. If she's not covering, she's still a Muslim. So just covering does not make her Muslim, just like Christian women not covering or Jewish women not covering does not make them non-Jewish or non-Christian. As a matter of fact, almost every major religion, women have some level of covering, which they have traditionally performed.
Okay. I want to ask you just one more thing about, because the female circumcision, talk about that kind of stuff, yeah. Just briefly.
Okay. Well, female
circumcision. It makes the news, we hear stuff about different things like this.
Right. Female circumcision is not a teaching of Islam. It is not something which Islam teaches. It is something which is practiced in some Islamic societies, particularly in Africa, and it is also done by African Christians. So this is a very traditional practice, but it has nothing to do with religion. Either Muslim animists, the pagans, African pagans and animists, they also do it, and some African Muslims also do it. But it has nothing to do with the faith itself, female circumcision. Sometimes it's called genital mutilation. As well, okay. Female genital mutilation.
So does the Quran, I think we touched on this, but I just want to be clear. Does the Quran say that those who don't convert to Islam must be killed?
No, it doesn't say that.
Okay.
It absolutely does not say, on the contrary, I'm sorry, can you say that question one more time?
Does the Quran say that those who don't convert to Islam must be killed?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, they were non-Muslims in the time of the Prophet who did not convert. They kept their faith. Some of them, the Jews, as well as the Christians, as well as the pagans, they were never killed. And even after that, there has never been a tradition of Muslims. Okay, Christians have had a tradition of persecution, or among Christian societies. I don't want to even say Christians. Among Christian societies, there has been the Inquisition and you know, the witch hunts and those types of things. Muslims traditionally have never had forced conversions or killing people who would not convert. As I said, this goes absolutely against the very fundamental teachings of Islam.
Okay. Do Muslims agree that sincerity of heart is more important than external words or actions?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
No question about that.
If a Muslim converts to Christianity, should he or she be punished? If so, what is just punishment according to the Quran? If the same person converts back to Islam, is he or she forgiven? And then it says Surah 4:48.
Yeah. As I said, religion is a matter of choice. People come in my office, and several ones of them have come. They become Muslim, and then after a week or a month, I never see them. That's the end of it. That's
never happened to us.
Yeah.
Come here. They come once. They stick, buddy. Yeah. We see them every week, all the time.
And I, as far as I know, nobody has tried to hunt them down. Nobody has done that, as far as I know.
Okay, so what is do you know what Surah 4:48 is?
I have no idea. I'll have to see what.
You don't have it all memorized?
Oh, no, I don't.
Come on.
You
guys better step it up. Where's your leaders out of your mosque? You better hold him. He should have all this memorized, don't you think? All right. Okay, another one based on Surah 5:51, which includes, take not the Jews.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Take not the Jews and the Christians for friends. They are friends one to another. Are Muslims allowed to be friends with Jews and Christians?
That's a good question. So this is a good translation. This is a good quotation. Take not Jews and Christians for friends. They are friends one to another. Are Muslims allowed to be friends with Jews and Christians? Have you heard the phrase called lost in translation?
Yeah.
Okay. The word used in Arabic is awliya. A more accurate translation, it is made by some translators, is allies. It's allies. In a military sense, in a sense of somebody who's going to protect you, somebody who's going to defend. Okay, you make like a military alliance. That's the context in which, that's the correct translation of this verse and of this word which should be used. The word in Arabic also means friends. The word which is used in this verse also means friend, and an incompetent translator picked that word and translated it like this. You say, you know what? I'm not convinced. Because obviously you're not going to sit over here and say, take not the Jews and Christians as friends, right? Because you want to be friends with us, you're sitting in the church, you do all this work. How can we trust you? I'll give you one thing. After that, you will have no doubt about what I have explained. And if you have more questions, you can ask me again. Muslim men are allowed to marry Jewish and Christian women according to the teaching of the Quran. They are allowed to marry. Several companions of Prophet Muhammad had Jewish and Christian wives. They married Jewish and Christian women. It was something which was even done in practice. Of course, not forcefully, by agreement. Not forcefully. How could it be that you have a wife, but you can't be friends with her? I mean, that just okay, defies common sense. So this is in the sense of an alliance, making an alliance, which is talking about the context at that time, where there was the Persian Empire on one side at that time. It doesn't even exist now, right? And there was the Roman Byzantine Empire on the other side. So it is in that context that it is talking about over here. Islam does not forbid friendly relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims. Islam does not forbid that. That's not the meaning of this verse in the Quran or anywhere else.
Yeah, very good. One last thing, I'll give you one last comment here. Would you like us to know anything that we've not covered that you would like us to know about Islam, or what do you believe are most common misconceptions Christians have? So this is an opportunity going to give you just about 5 minutes to say, is there anything you want to clear up that we haven't covered, or anything that you think we need to know about Islam or that Christians tend to assume?
Well, I'll say a few points. One of them is, like, if you have time and if you have interest, please try to learn a little bit more about the Islamic teaching of Tawheed, or the Islamic teaching about the belief in God. Okay, what is exactly that Muslims believe about God and the belief in prophets? So that's one area which I would invite you to explore and to learn more about, if you so desire. The second thing which I will say is, if you ever have questions, please do not hesitate. I am very accessible. You can come always to our mosque, to our Islamic center. You can always contact Jim. So it's not just like I came over here one time. If you have ever questions, like, okay, why is this happening? I read this. Is this anything you have on your mind? You can call, you can email, you can drop by. The doors are always open. So I really want to, give that, invitation. Like, don't feel at all threatened or hesitant or shy to come in to ask. And don't feel like, I might be, this question might be offensive. It's better to be offensive than to be ignorant. And we may not agree. We may not agree. I mean, I will not give you an answer which I think you will agree with, but I'll try to give you the answer which I think is the correct answer. We may agree to disagree, and this was the basis of our friendship. This is one of my first conversations which I had with Pastor Jim Powell. We can agree to disagree, and then we can move forward. But if we don't even sit down and talk, we will never know about each other. And I think that was, the one of the best moments where I developed friendship with him. So we don't have to agree on things, but we can at least see, separate fact from fiction, and separate, things which people are propagating for corporate profit from what is actually practiced and believed by people, by Muslims. I would ask, there was a question asked last week, like, okay, you have, we know Islam is not a bad religion. All right, thank you very much. We know about this. What's next? This was a question which was asked like that last time. I don't think it's a matter of just attending one lecture, which is a good thing. It should be an ongoing process. We need to learn more about each other as much as our time and resources allow. Muslims need to know more about Christians. Christians need to know a little bit more about Muslims. It's an ongoing thing. So it's not just like one time you come, you hear, and that's the end of it. We need to encourage this type of friendly discussion. And where we are honest and frank enough to say, we can agree to disagree. We might differ about, the Bible and the Quran. We might differ about, how we look at Muhammad, peace be upon him, and Jesus, peace be upon him, or Moses, peace be upon him. We can differ about those things. But we can at least also sit down and have an honest, heart-to-heart conversation where I will get the answers, which are probably, not biased by media and, other things. But thank you very much for inviting. I am very grateful to be over here. I'm very grateful for all of you to come. I'm very grateful to my very good friend, and I always refer to him as my friend, as well as Rabbi Daniel Bogart. He also invited him to our mosque as well. And he gave a four-week session as well. Pastor Jim Powell also gave a four-week session, and he was able to speak whatever he has, I mean, it's not like you can preach the gospel over here. You, whatever your message is, come sit over here, discuss it with people. That's fine. And people can ask you questions. So I really appreciate my friendship with him. You have an excellent pastor. And I hope that, you know, we will continue working towards a promotion of peace and building bridges of understanding. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, our hope for this series, we didn't obviously get to 100% of the questions. We tried to get as many as we could in. You know, what I shared with our church is that I talked to some of our staff members and I talked to our elders. We discussed before we did this sermon series, and we really believed it was time, and we believed that we needed to challenge our church. I'm very proud of Richwood's Christian Church, I think, as a whole. Our congregation has been very open. They've been very teachable in this, and the number of people that have come to me that have said, boy, I can't believe how foolish I was, or we didn't know these things, and it's been very, very good. There was a lot of people that were a little nervous about this going into it, and but I'm very proud of our church, and I'm proud of all of you for being so teachable and open even to be here tonight. I believe that, and I tried to articulate this weekend, ignorance and fear does not help any of us. It doesn't help us in our Christian faith. It doesn't help us to live the gospel or the good news of Jesus. And the same thing is true for our Muslim friends. And I think that we can agree to disagree. We need to hold to our convictions. But I don't think that ignorance and fear helps anybody. And the only way we overcome that oftentimes comes through a relationship. It's through overcoming our fear, stepping out, making ourselves vulnerable. And I believe, as I challenge the church this weekend, as Christians, we are called to move towards, to present greeting and openness. And hopefully, in some small way, our church will be able to advance the conversation to make our Muslim neighbors feel more welcome. And hopefully you will continue to teach us as we learn from you, that hopefully we'll be strengthened in our faith as well, and God will be glorified. Let me close this. Do you mind if I close this in prayer?
Sure,
and then
please.
We will we'll wrap up.
I will say my prayer. You can say yours.
Okay. All right. Very good.
I'll say my Arabic words. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. What this means is how praise and perfect God is. I seek God's forgiveness and turn to him in repentance.
Very good. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time, and I thank you for our friends that are joining us tonight. I thank you for the teachability of our church body that's come out this evening, and just to be able to hear and to learn more. Father, I pray that you will help us, Lord, to be able to model your love, your compassion, even as I look through the Quran and just see the emphasis upon compassion and mercy and every one of their chapters, how it introduces the idea of compassion and mercy. I know that those Muslims that are committed to following Allah, that they are committed to peace, they are committed to compassion and mercy. And I pray, Lord, that you help us as followers of Jesus to likewise commit ourselves to be people of peace. And Lord, that as we share the good news, more than just sharing, that we would live the good news. And dear God, that we would make this world a better place. And I pray that in the process that you will be glorified. Strengthen us to overcome our fears, our misconceptions. Help us, dear God, to shed light on our other friends that maybe are still walking in ignorance about what Muslims may or may not believe. And I pray, dear God, that you strengthen and help all of us. In the name of Jesus Christ, we pray these things. Amen. Amen. So God bless you all. Feel free to mingle afterwards. So thank you so much for being here. Thanks, everybody, for coming out tonight. God bless you all.